Good morning, this is Don Wynn. I'm here today with my brothers Tony and Collins. We're going to be talking about our aunts and uncles on our mother's side today. There are three of those. Our mother had two brothers and a sister, and we're going to talk about them in the order in which they were born. And our oldest uncle is Herbert Hines Brazelton Jr., I believe. Isn't that his name correctly, Collins?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. The funny thing is, we go back to the name thing again about her grandfather, you know, but Uncle Hines, our uncle we're talking about today, his name is actually Herbert Hines Brazelton Jr., and he was named after his father, but his father's name was not Herbert. His father's name was Hubbard, but that's just an interesting thing. And but it's Herbert Hines Brazelton Jr., and he was born in October 1913. I think he was 70 years old when he died, something like that. At 67. I'm sure y'all remember he was in the hospital. When our mother was in the hospital, and he died just about the same time.
Yeah, talking about the hospital. I know one of the things that really defined his life was the injury that he had when he was working for TVA when they were doing the Tennessee River dams, building the dams. Collins, do you know much about that, about his injuries?
Well, like I had over the years, you know, like I think like all of us, we've heard snippets of stories here and there, but certainly he was, without question, he was severely injured in some manner working for TBA, and what they were doing was clearing out the trees and what have you from the new river bottom or the lake bottom that was going to be when the dams were fully up and operational. So they were clearing trees and doing a lot of hard work like that. I assume with mules, and probably so, because it'd be too rough for tractors that whatever was available. So, and apparently somehow or other, he injured his left arm severely. I mean, it's not just a break. I mean, he had some sort of severe injury to his arm that he had the rest of his life. The story I got, Don, that this would have been the 1930s when he was injured, when the TBA was getting up and running, and he dealt with that the rest of his life.
Now, I had heard a family story, and one of y'all or both of y'all will know if it's true or not. I heard that when he got injured, he was so afraid of not being able to work and make the income that he worked with his hands stuck in his pocket so that they would not know that he had messed up his arm.
That sounds reasonable to me. I mean, in fact, our Uncle Alan had a situation that way as well. We'll talk about it in a minute. So, yeah, and that makes sense to me. We were talking a little earlier, we've been going through some postcards and letters and things of that sort from that part of our family. There are several notes in there from Uncle Hines that when he would write home, and this is in the 1940, 41, in that area of time, and he's writing from the U.S. Marine Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. And I think just putting two and two together, we've talked about this a little before, that probably he was there in an effort to repair his arm. But Don, you were talking about he would not let them remove his arm. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think back to what Tony was saying, I think his injury might have been minor if he had it taken care of when it first happened. But he didn't. He kept working, from what I understand, and didn't get it treated. And when he finally did, the problem had gotten so much worse that he was in danger of losing his arm. And he refused to let them cut his arm off, his lower arm, his forearm. And so apparently what they did is they took out one of the bones in his forearm And of course, that limited his ability to move his. He could move his hand and stuff, but no strength or anything. But the thing that's unusual about that is I've never heard of anybody ever that's just had a single bone removed out of their forearm. So I think it was must have been a really, really unusual type of treatment plan that they had for him. And
he was injured, but apparently recovered, came home, and then set about doing what work that he could do. Of course, the Paddens were all farmers of one form or the other. And so I'm sure that he was, you know, right back into that life. And I've noticed he, a few years later, 4 or 5 years later, I think, you know, he was married in 1945, got married and began a family. Eventually, the 5 or 6 children, I believe I'd have to sit down and count, but a large family.
Yeah.
One of his children was twins, the two boys, Melvin and Calvin. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is. They had a set of twins. Let's see now. Let me see if I can name them. Walter, Dorcas, Edward, Calvin, Melvin, and Sarah, I believe.
Yes, that's correct. That's what I'm
right.
Okay, yeah. And Calvin and Melvin were twins. I gather from everything that I've heard over the years that the entire family was born at home.
All except Sarah. Sarah was born in a hospital. And apparently what happened, he delivered his own kids, or he and his wife together. I don't think they had a midwife or a doctor or anybody in attendance. And I believe with the twins, there were some sort of complications with the delivery. And it happened at home. And because of that particular the problems that they had, they didn't want to risk that again, so that's the reason that Sarah was born in a hospital, or at least it contributed to the decision.
Yeah.
To make sure they delivered Sarah in the hospital. And they lived in rural areas, so when she was went into labor, it might have been a chore to get to the hospital. You know what I'm, it might have been, that might be the reason others were born at home, part of it.
Well, yeah, I understand that completely. You know, we know some of the areas where they lived, and you're right, it's very rural, and of course, that's where a farmer lives, is in rural areas, so, to my knowledge, the family did fine, you know. I think Walter was the oldest, is an Army veteran. I think Dorcas was in the finance business for years with one of the local banks there. Edwards worked his entire life, done well. They all have their own families. I'm not so sure about Calvin and Melvin. Probably both of those young men probably struggled, but only because that they had these difficulties, both physical and mental difficulties. And then I think Sarah's done well, to my knowledge, Don, and you may have heard from her some years ago.
I did, but I haven't maintained contact, but I am proud of my cousins, and I'm proud of all my cousins, but this particular family, I'm proud of them. They're upstanding people, and, you know, I wouldn't expect anything else from the Braslin side of our family.
Well, that's certainly true. That's certainly true. And like I said, they've done well, I think. A sidelight here, just so you know, Uncle Hines was married to Margaret Earlene Self, S-E-L-F was her name, and actually she was his first cousin. She was, and lived there in the area around the family home out in Berkeley. And I ran across that, Don, when I was doing a little research, and it caught my eye, and I looked into it, and that's actually true.
Wow. That doesn't happen today, and I guess it had to be back then that, you know, that would commonly happen, I would imagine.
Yeah.
That's a small world, you know. I don't want to sound coarse about it, but the bottom line was, you know, you had to choose a mate and a partner from those people who are available around you, you know. And but she was a fine lady too. I enjoyed her. She was always kind to me and pleasant, and I always appreciated her.
Yeah, I did too. I remember her as exactly the same way. One thing I remember about our Uncle Hines is our mother always told me that I reminded her of him. And I think when he was young, he was sort of a man about town in a way. We've got some pictures of him that really, really good pictures, I think. Dressed up, you know, just a guy that's really interesting looking, but he's also was a really a smart guy too, I think, even though he might not have gone to school very much, you know, not much formal education, but that's what our mother always told me, that I reminded her of our Uncle Hines. Good or bad?
I remember visits that Mom and Uncle Hines would have together. He would come to the house, and they would sit down and talk, drink coffee, and I would sit there and listen. And I remember Uncle Hines, he must have read quite a bit, because he always had knowledge. Now, some of it was opinionated knowledge, but still, you know, he had to read quite a bit to come up with his ideas.
Right.
And his opinions.
Exactly.
I always remember that about him. I always thought he was neat because he was like that, because he had all this knowledge.
Well,
you know, after him, after Uncle Hines in the family, Uncle Allen was born next. Allen Walker Rattleson was born in 1916, a couple years later. And boy, Uncle Allen is a man in his own right as well. You know, Don, you made some comments about him in the past. Our Uncle Allen was a stand-up guy, to use your words. I mean, he was number one as far as I'm concerned. Boy, he's a first-class guy.
I think he was tough,
well,
too. He was a tough man. You know, he could deal with the challenges that life presents or whatever, and... You know, I don't know anything negative at all about him. He's really a model for the way people ought to act, I think.
Well, what little I know of him is, I know he, when he got married, his wife had two children. The lady he married already had two children, and he raised those children, which speaks highly of him for me.
Yeah, and they were close throughout their lives. I mean, he and Margie, his wife, had two kids of their own, so they had four kids total, and they were all real close to and that says a lot about their family, what family life was, and how they felt about each other.
Yeah, that's true. You know, there were four boys. It was the first two was Jerry and Wayland. And then Langston, their name was Langston, and then Ken, our cousins Ken and David Bradson. So there were four boys in that family. And you're right. I mean, Don, over the years, I can recall they were always, the discussion was always about the entire family, not just part of them.
Right. And I remember a couple things about Uncle Allen. One is Margie didn't drive, so when Margie wanted to come over and see our mother, Alan would drive her over, and I think he always had Cadillacs, I think, big cars, and they would show up, and Margie would talk to our mother, and Alan would be in there and talk for, and after 15, 20 minutes, he'd go out and get in the car. He didn't stay long, and he'd sit in the car for a little while, and then he'd honk the horn, and you know, he'd tell Margie, we got to go. But they did visit, and he was real cordial and all of that. He just didn't want to stay a long time. That's always just, to me, pretty interesting about him.
You know, I understand, Don, that he and Margie both, his wife, Margie Langston, I understand both of them worked in the cotton mills for 40 years. And retired. In fact, you told me before a story I didn't know about Uncle Allen, about him losing that finger in the mill.
Yeah, I think he worked, you know, even he might have been almost a child laborer in the mill, and he worked there his entire life, and it supported his family, and he was proud of the people he worked with. I don't think he liked the supervisors too much because they weren't the same as the guy he was working with shoulder to shoulder. But he liked Joe Bradley, who was the plant manager, and the school's named after him now. But when he got injured, he took off, got his hand caught in a machine, and it took a finger off. And I don't know if the supervisor said to him, you better be here tomorrow or what, or if he just knew that he better be there. But even though he'd lost his entire finger, and I'm not talking about the tip, I mean the entire finger, the next day he bandaged up and went to work anyway. There must have been horrible pain and you know, everything that would go with that. But he goes to work the next day, and the reason was because he knew that if he didn't, he would lose his job. Now,
you know, that was not a wonderful time in the labor movement in America, Donnie. You know, I recall Uncle Allen talking about the supervisor. He called, he locked them all together, and he called them the man, and in very derogatory tones of the man this and the man that. And so, which, you know, that's a very real illustration of the tension between management and labor. You know, I think the mill actually had several strikes over the years. Some of them were pretty serious.
Well, we all know the history of all of the mills around Huntsville. We grew up there, and there were, what, four or five mills, Collins, is that right?
I think so, yeah, all around Huntsville, yeah.
And they have a history of child labor, you know, because we've seen some of the pay stubs from children working there. And from what my understanding is, they like children working there because they have small hands and they could work on the equipment. Yeah, but it was a tough job and hard work. And like you say, if you have tension with the people in charge, it makes it even worse. It must have been a hard atmosphere to work in.
Well, and that's part of the reason I said he was tough. You know, he and Margie both, I think they both were tough. And they live right across the street, Triana Boulevard in Huntsville, from the factory, the mill itself. And they call them mill villages because at that point, I don't think the mill owned the houses. But and they had the company store and all of that where they worked and where they bought things, and they also had the school that was affiliated with the mill. What was the name of that mill, C. Collins?
I think it changed once or twice over the years, but I knew it as Merrimack.
Merrimack.
Yeah. And you're right. The supervisor, perhaps even the founder, was a man named Joe Bradley, and of course, and then the company school was named after him. And of course, in fact, I even went to the first grade in that school. It's long since gone now. I've been torn down, demolished, and what have you. But I tell you, I always enjoyed Uncle Allen and Aunt Margie because they were both, in their own ways, very witty people, especially Uncle Allen. And he had a sense of humor about him that was really refreshing. And Margie, she just kind of did her own thing and was just wonderful. You know, you could not go to their house except you're going to sit down and have some coffee, hear some cake, do you want something to eat, can't you stay for supper, all of that sort of thing. And they were just wonderful people.
Yeah, they had a lot of hospitality. You're absolutely right.
I remember Aunt Margie as being one of the sweetest people I think I've ever known. She always hugged on me and you know, give you attention, was very kind.
Yeah, I couldn't say enough about either one of them. I know both of them, since they worked in the mill there and they lived in the village, the people that lived around them and that worked with them was really, really an important part of their lives. You know, you could talk to them or they'd talk about somebody's name. They'd say, yeah, I remember when working with them and so-and-so in the loom room. or something, you know, like everything was affiliated with the work and with the village, the people that lived around them. And it's just such a special time, I think, even though the work was hard.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's also very good about the two of them is the quality and the character of the four young men that they raised. I mean, they had four sons who were just outstanding people. You know, I mean, gosh knows, I mean, David was as wonderful a guy as you ever met. And so was Ken, and Jerry and Waylon were the same way. I think Ken is the only living son now. But Jerry and Waylon were just like, well, just grand young men, and it was because of the kind of parents they had.
Yeah, you know, when I think about Ken and David, of course, they're a little bit older than I am, you know, and I always looked up to them, but Ken always reminded me of Elvis Presley. He had these vivid eyes, and he just, the way he acted, the way he moved and everything, he was Elvis to me. And David...
He was a cool guy.
And David reminded me of Fonzie. Of course, that's a lot later, and that's from Happy Days TV show. But he was a cool guy, too, but just a different kind of cool. But they were both real cool.
Great. Yeah, one wonderful family. Yeah. And then, which leads us to our last aunt and uncle, mother's brothers and sisters, our Aunt Phoebe. And gosh knows, we talked about her a little bit when we were talking about doing an interview about her mom several weeks ago. But and Phoebe, like all the rest, you know, is just a first-class person, and she had her own attributes and a wonderful family, made her own life, you know.
She went to school up here in Nashville. I believe she went to Peabody, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, I think, Tony, I can't recall directly, but I think it was either, or perhaps both, Austin Peay or David Lipscomb, you know, perhaps both of them. And, but she was very fond of that, and certainly rightfully so, very proud of going to college, I think probably because she knew that her grandfather had gone to medical school right there at Vanderbilt University.
I think
she liked it up here evidently, because this is where she made her life, is up in Middle Tennessee.
She was proud of Nashville. She was so proud of where she lived in Nashville and all the things that you could do there. But I think she went to Peabody, and that she worked at Lipscomb. You know, she went to school, and then she worked at the other school for until she retired from there. And I think she had other jobs after she retired, but she was affiliated with both.
Lipscomb University is a Church of Christ school. It's affiliated with the Church of Christ.
Yeah, and I think the university is doing well. I mean, you know, it's certainly growing and changing just like everything else. You know, Aunt Phoebe was, she was the baby, if you will, of the family. But, you know, we talked before, I think her brothers and sisters and her parents kind of pitched in, and somehow or other the decision was made to try to send her to college. And they certainly did that. I mean, because there wasn't any scholarships, I don't believe, to speak of, although she might have gotten some. But I'm sure they paid her way through school. And, you know, Don, I think I recall about Aunt Phoebe, I have to say that she had a young, I hate to say boyfriend, I think it's more quality than that, but a young man that she was fond of, that she spent a lot of time with there in Huntsville and around and about. And I think that he either became sick and passed away, or had some sort of an accident and passed away as a very young man, long before they were to ever have married. And then she was, I think, there in Nashville, she was trying to regain her life, you know, get her feet back under her and that sort of thing. And she met her Uncle C.D. up there, I believe.
Yeah, I think, I believe that's true.
Uncle CB, from the time that I knew him, he was a life insurance salesman. Well, I won't say life and casualty insurance company. In Nashville area was big. It was big in medical hospitals and stuff, and big in insurance companies. But he sold life insurance, I believe.
Yeah, and
he's a good guy. I always enjoyed being around him and Aunt Phoebe. They were just, again, just wonderful people, always welcoming, And as when we're young guys, Tony, I think probably you're involved in this as well. I mean, we'd be shipped off to Nashville for a week or so during the summer. I know that Don and I went, and I've often thought that that was to let them practice being parents, but we always had a good time, and Aunt Phoebe always had a full day plan for every day we were up there. And we'd go to museums, and Don, you may remember, we'd go to the theater downtown Nashville, just all kinds of wonderful things that they would do with us. And like I said, CD was a great guy. I didn't learn until later on, Don, that he was a veteran of World War II as well. He was a very soft-spoken guy, but he was a tech sergeant in the Army and was a veteran of World War II.
Well, the thing about life and casualty, they were proud that he worked there because part of the reason was because it was a sponsor of the Grand Ole Opry on television. So it'd be the life and casualty sponsor of one of the most popular shows on TV then, or probably the radio too. But he was a solid man. He was an entrepreneur of sorts. I think at one point he owned a laundromat. I mean, and there was an older man that he had met, they had befriended, and every night, and this man was disabled and couldn't take care of himself and stuff, and every night I believe that our Uncle CD would go over and spend the night with that man overnight because he was disabled. And he'd get up in the morning and come home and change clothes, get ready for work and everything. And he did that for the balance of that man's life. And it was just a family friend. And I also know that he and our Aunt Phoebe were real church-oriented. Her church was really important to her. And that was a lifelong thing, heavy involvement in their church.
In fact, I can remember going with them when we were up there, Todd. Do you recall that?
I do remember that. And, you were talking about those trips when we would go up there. Our mother would take us downtown and put us on a Greyhound bus. And I couldn't have been more than, I don't know. I might have been 6 years old, 7 years old.
Yeah,
something
like that, yeah. And you'd ride that Greyhound bus by yourself to Nashville, and they would meet you at the bus station and get you off.
Right.
Not only that, if I recall, Don, I think that there was a stop in route in Lewisburg, Tennessee.
Yes.
And this thing bus stopped, and me and you, or perhaps even Tony once or twice, but I know that you and I, Don, I was. If you were six, I would have been eight, and so we would have got off the bus and walked around a bus station in Lewisburg, Tennessee, and then got back on the bus and went on to Nashville. I mean, that's a pretty that's a pretty telling thing if you stop to think about it.
There was something else. You were talking about taking us to movies and museums and stuff. She did all of that. I mean, she great aunt. I mean. She really, really went out of her way to make sure we enjoyed where we were and what we're doing and all of that, and it was educational. But one thing I remember that she did is I believe they allowed you to go to the movie by yourself. It was the one of the Disney color movies, one of the very first ones, and I remember I didn't go. I don't know how come, but I didn't go to the movie. And they let you go to the movie by yourself in downtown Nashville. They dropped you off in front of the movie theater, and we picked you up. Do you remember?
Yeah, you know, I do, Don. I remember it was one of those huge old Victorian style theaters, you know, with the box seats down the sides of the walls and the balconies and all of the ornate detail work done in the auditorium. And I thought it was just grand. I mean, I sat in that movie all by myself, and I probably put my seat, my feet up on the seat back and all that kind of stuff that a young boy would do. And I sat there and enjoyed that movie. And you're right, all along, and when the movie was over, I just got up, walked outside, and first thing you know, here come the car along, and they picked me up, and we went home.
You know, but imagine doing that with an eight-year-old boy today in a strange big city, drop him off, let him go to movies. You know, that just wouldn't happen today. But that's part of the reason who we are. You know, we were taught
a little bit about Uncle CD, and I was going to say, you talked about him being an entrepreneur, and one of the ways that he got into that, I think it's just his nature, for one thing. You know, he just was particularly good at it. But he also, because he worked what was referred to as a debit route, in other words, people paid insurance premiums in person to the agent, and they paid them every week. And so he would go from house to customer, I guess is the way you would say that, client to client once a week, picking up the payment for the insurance policy, and kept a huge, big old thick debit book, I think is what it was called. But because of that, it's my understanding that sometimes somebody might not have the dollar that was necessary to pay that week's premium, and he would work out some sort of trade, maybe for a dish that he noticed sitting on a table or gosh knows whatever else, and which led him into the antique business.
Go
ahead, Don.
Well, he dealt in coins, too, old coins. And when he ran his laundromat that I believe he owned, he didn't just operate it, he owned the laundromat. And I know people would pay for their washing and drying with old coins that had value for the coin, like V nickels and barber dimes and stuff. And I remember going up there and he'd show me the coins that he'd gotten, you know, valuable coins through this laundromat. But he was really an interesting man. He did other things too. He wrote some country music songs, and he tried to get them published. He never did, I don't think, but he did play the guitar and write songs too.
He played the mandolin too, which people would tell you was a really difficult instrument to play.
You know, I recall one visit, and I don't know who was there. I know that my wife Judy and I, when we were first married, stopped by there, which would have been the early 90s, 91, 92, something like that, and stopped by and visited with them and Uncle CD. Nothing would do, but we walked in the living room, had a seat, and he got out his guitar and was what they call it, strumming and singing or playing or something like that. And yeah, he was a very talented person all the way around, very very original kind of guy. And he and Aunt Phoebe made a good team, I think.
Yeah, they did.
You know, such family oriented and all of that kind of stuff, and wonderful parents.
So they had two children. They had two children, George Clay Williams and Susan Williams. And George Clay was the oldest, and Susan was the youngest, and both of them still around the area today. They went to a school right over by the house. They lived on a house on Barton Avenue, and they went to school right over, and I cannot remember. The school is still there. I just cannot remember the name of it.
Yeah, they were great cousins, both of them. In fact, I'm sure probably like y'all, I've gotten to know them better as an older man than I ever would have as a 30-year-old guy. I don't know if that's a comment about where we are in life or what, but George Clay and Susan both are very, they have the same wit of their parents. You know, they are smart, smart people and very witty. George Clay especially, very dry and but smart guy, you know, smart guy.
George Clay always told me that he was born 100 years too late. he wanted to be a frontiersman, and he was good at it. And he shot a mountain lion. He took a trip to Colorado on a mountain lion hunt, and he shot a mountain lion and killed it with a flintlock. I don't mean just black powder. I'm talking about flintlock, where the hammer comes down and strikes the, and lights the powder in the pan and fires the gun like they used in a Revolutionary War thing. And that had to take guts.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. So I guess to sum up today's interview, you know, we talked about three of our aunts and uncles, plus two uncles and an aunt. I guess from everything we talked about here today, I mean, they're all, irregardless of anything else, that they all have descendants that are great people, all upstanding, you know, well-behaved, dependable, solid, smart, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it says a lot about Mom's family.
You know, all of these interviews that we've done, I don't know that we've had anybody in our family that really had any kind of trouble with law of any large degree.
Not that I know of either. I really don't on either side of our family. You know, there's no record of anybody ever being incarcerated or anything like that. So, you know, I guess we're too dull.
I guess we just didn't get caught.
There's always that, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's just more detail to our family. Today's interview has been really, really fun for me to remember these people and think about the things that we know from firsthand experience and our cousins. And we didn't say too much about Susan, but she's our youngest cousin, maybe, and she's just a wonderful person too. So I couldn't say enough positive about anybody in our on that side of our family in particular. But
yeah, you know, Don, I'm in touch with Susan quite often. Really, email back and forth, and I'll put something on the internet, and she'll comment about it. You know, and so, like I said, we're a lot tighter now as in older age than we ever were when we were busy raising our own family.
Yeah,
I enjoyed these interviews from a different perspective than you two guys. A lot of the things that y'all will say are things that I may have heard, but I didn't really experience them firsthand like you did. And all these stories are very interesting to me because it builds out people that I know and makes them more real, gives flesh to their bones and makes them more real to me.
Well, you know, what we're doing,
I'm doing that way.
This is a gift that we're all giving to our descendants. And there's no other way to think about it than that. It's pleasant for us, but it's a gift for people that are going to follow us and our families. But anyway, I think we finished our interview today, and we spent almost 40 minutes, so it's been a pretty good interview, but there's so much to talk about and such a vibrant family. So we'll get back together next week.
Bye.